application and upload the required documents, such as a photo ID and eligibility documentation. All online applications are accessible to screen readers and were tested by free and reduced fare riders to ensure usability. Riders who submit their email address as part of their application will receive application status notifications, including details on how to use their card if approved. In addition to the online applications, the MBTA recently removed rider photos, names, and expiration dates from senior trolley cards for people 65 and older to simplify the card fulfillment process for these riders. Riders who apply for a new or replacement senior trolley card will now receive the new reduced fare trolley cards for seniors, which are valid for 8 years. Riders with current senior trolley cards can utilize them until they expire. To learn more about the MBTA's free and reduced fare programs and how to apply online, visit this website, mbta.com/fares/reduced. That again, mbta.com/fares/reduced.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WVDF Liberal, WRS Liberal, WRSLP Pittsfield, WLLA Montgomery, WVAALPFL, WDJY. Framingham.
Coming up next from the Talking Information Center, new stories from the Brockton Enterprise.
This is Dan Cobran for the Talking Information Center, reading the Brockton Enterprise for November 30th, 2022. Baker seeks federal aid for migrants. Brockton Among Areas Seeing Numbers Rise by Anna Guarasso. Governor Charlie Baker has called on the federal government to step in and provide more support to migrants seeking essential services in response to an increase in the number of people seeking assistance from local humanitarian aid organizations. Massachusetts is proud to welcome individuals and families seeking asylum and refuge and is dedicated to helping families live with dignity. But additional federal support is required, Baker said in a recent letter to Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas and Health and Human Services Secretary Xavier Becerra. Baker's letter follows a call from the state's congressional delegation for the federal government to step in and support organizations trying to manage an increasing number of migrants, especially in areas like Brockton and Stoughton, where some of 47 Venezuelan migrants sent to Martha's Vineyard in September have resettled. According to the Massachusetts Office for Refugees and Immigrants, the state welcomed about 1,000 refugees, migrants, and asylum seekers, but delegation members wrote in their letter that the pace has increased this year in cities like Boston. Estimates suggest that over 2,000 migrants, primarily from Haiti and South American countries, arrived in the Boston area between May and August 2022, they said. Massachusetts organizations have capably provided dignified humanitarian assistance to people in need. However, they have also told us that they need more resources to support the growth in the number of migrants arriving within the relatively short period. Catholic Charities Boston, the largest social services nonprofit in Massachusetts, offering assistance ranging from food security to legal matters, has seen an increase recently in people requiring essential services, according to Marie-Jean Pierrot, Vice President of Refugee and Immigration Services. Our community sites in Brockton, Dorchester, South Boston definitely see an increase in foot traffic, said Pierrot, who has served in her position since 2005. But she said it's difficult to determine the exact number of migrants coming to community sites because the organization also serves non-migrants. The Brockton location on Court Street offers a food pantry, free English classes, and other essential needs services. We don't want to scare anybody away, right? So we're not going to say, where are your papers? Where did you arrive from? She said. What I can say with certainty is that we do see an increase in people needing our services. Curhoe noted that her team also had to help community partners overwhelmed with intake. "We're pivoting a lot and trying to think of creative ways to serve a high number of people at one time," she said. "I think that's part of the challenge. That's all of that all of us in the humanitarian business of making sure people are safe. We want to help, but you don't know who's coming, so we can't be planful. We can't organize." The delegation's letter, released by Senator Elizabeth Warren October 25th and sent to Federal Emergency Management Agency Administrator Deanne Criswell and Emergency Food and Shelter Program Chair Michael Lee, aimed to attract more outreach to locations or location organizations in the state unaware of the federal support programs. "We already asked FEMA and DHS to award EFSP funds as quickly and with as little bureaucratic delay as possible to Massachusetts organizations that are providing humanitarian aid to migrants," they said. "We also hope that FEMA would provide ample leadership of or assistance with these efforts to avoid placing a major new burden on Massachusetts-based organizations, such as lead county agencies that are already performing other crucial services for our communities." Catholic Charities of Boston is one of the Massachusetts organizations receiving funding, but Perreault noted that obtaining FEMA and EFSP funds is a complicated process. "It's not something that groups here have been applying for, and it's been more reserved for border states," she said. "Massachusetts organizations need more guidance on that and streamlining the process, making it a little easier to apply and release those funds." She said that sometimes necessary funds can get held up in Washington, D.C., and take more time to come to local communities. In addition to increasing access to federal funds, Baker's letter said that the state needs more federal support in helping migrants obtain employment and rebuild their lives without straining local public services. "A faster path to legal employment would not only provide these individuals with a path to self-sustainability, but would also aid Massachusetts employers who are eager to hire amidst the current workforce shortage," he said. According to his letter, it can take up to a year for new arrivals to receive federal work authorization. Many asylum seekers aren't eligible until their asylum application has been pending for 180 days. Perreault said that expediting work authorization processes could help many migrants seeking help from organizations like Catholic Charities, and is a big way the federal government can support Massachusetts. "Having a work permit and having a job is one of the first ways that migrants can start to get on their own two feet and not need as much assistance from public sources," she said. "When we don't give people the tools to work, everybody suffers." In the meantime, Perreault noted that Catholic Charities Boston, as part of a network of community organizations statewide, will continue to strive to provide safe and welcoming spaces for migrants. "We try our best to meet those needs where we can, and if there's something we can't do, we try to make sure you can get referred to another place that can," she said. "We can make a difference, even if it's just one person that gets a job, gets their green card, or can reunite with their family. At the end of the day, we're all humans, and when we look at people through the lens of humanity, I believe we can get so much more done and move our Commonwealth forward." NATO Commits to Future Ukraine Membership by Stephen McGrath, Lauren Cook, and Alan Nickermeyer. Bucharest, Romania. NATO allies reaffirmed their commitment to Ukraine on Tuesday, saying that the war-torn nation will one day become a member of the world's largest security alliance, and promising more help, from winter aid to artillery, to help Ukraine's beleaguered armed forces to fight off Russia. The pledges of support in Romania's capital, Bucharest, came as U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken met with NATO foreign ministers Tuesday to drum up urgently needed support aimed at ensuring that Moscow fails to defeat Ukraine as it bombards vital energy infrastructure. "NATO's doors open," NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said before chairing the meeting. "Russia does not have a veto on countries joining," he said in reference to the recent entry of North Macedonia and Montenegro into the Security Alliance. He said that Russian President Vladimir Putin will get Finland and Sweden as NATO members soon. The Nordic neighbors applied for membership in April, concerned that Russia might target them next. "We stand by that too on membership for Ukraine," the former Norwegian Prime Minister said. In essence, Stoltenberg repeated a vow made by NATO leaders in Bucharest in 2008. In the same sprawling palace of the parliament, where the foreign ministers are meeting this week, that Ukraine and also Georgia would join the alliance one day. Some officials and analysts believe this move, pressed on the NATO allies by former U.S. President George W. Bush, was partly responsible for the war that Russia launched on Ukraine in February. Stoltenberg disagreed. President Putin cannot deny sovereign nations to make their own sovereign decisions that are not a threat to Russia, he said. I think what he's afraid of is democracy and freedom, and that's the main challenge for him. Beyond Ukraine's immediate needs, NATO wants to see how it can help this country longer term by upgrading its Soviet-era equipment to the alliance's modern standards and providing more military training. This will help Ukraine to join NATO more quickly in the years after the war has ended. Slovak Foreign Minister Radoslav Kaser said the allies must help Ukraine so that the transition to full membership will be very smooth and easy once both NATO and Kyiv are ready for accession talks. Even so, Ukraine will not join NATO anytime soon. With the Crimean Peninsula annexed and Russian troops and pro-Moscow separatists holding parts of the south and east, it's not clear what Ukraine's borders would even look like. Many of NATO's 30 allies believe the focus now must solely be on defeating Russia, and Stoltenberg stressed that any attempt to move ahead on membership could divide them. We are in the midst of a war, and therefore we should do nothing that can undermine the unity of the allies to provide military, humanitarian, financial support to Ukraine, because we must prevent President Putin from winning, he said. Some ministers made pledges of military support for Ukraine, others for financial and non-lethal aid. Slovakia said it was providing Ukraine with 30 armored personnel carriers and more artillery. During the two-day meeting, Blinken will announce substantial U.S. aid for Ukraine's energy grid, U.S. officials said. Estonia's foreign minister, Urmas Reinsalu, went a step further than most, calling on his NATO partners to pledge 1% of their GDP to Ukraine in military support, saying it would make a strategic difference. Most NATO allies, however, are struggling to spend 2% of GDP on their own defense budgets. The ministers will hold a working dinner with their Ukrainian counterpart, Dmytro Kuleba, on Tuesday evening. The foreign ministers of NATO candidates, Finland and Sweden, are joining the talks. Census Bureau Director defends new privacy tool by Mike Schneider, the Associated Press. The U.S. Census Bureau's chief is defending a new tool meant to protect the privacy of people participating in the statistical agency's questionnaires against calls by prominent researchers to abandon it, claiming it jeopardizes the usefulness of numbers that are the foundation of the nation's data infrastructure. The tool, known as differential privacy, was selected as the best solution available against efforts by outside groups or individuals to piece together the identities of participants in the Bureau's censuses and surveys by using third-party data and powerful computers, U.S. Census Bureau Director Robert Santos said in a letter last week. Concerns about privacy have grown in recent years as cyber attacks and threats of personal data being used for the wrong reasons have become more commonplace. Several prominent state demographers and academic researchers had asked the statistical agency in August to abandon using differential privacy on future annual population estimates, which are used in the distribution of $1.5 trillion in federal funding each year, and future releases of American Community Survey data, which provide the most comprehensive information on how people live in the U.S. Demographers and researchers said the application of the privacy method for the first time in 2020 census data had delayed their release and created inaccuracies in the numbers used to determine political power and distribute federal funds. The researchers said in their letter that there were thousands of small jurisdictions throughout the U.S. that won't get usable data because of the algorithms applied to the numbers to protect confidentiality. By continuing to use the differential privacy algorithms, the Census Bureau risks failing its responsibilities as a federal statistical agency to provide relevant, accurate, timely, and credible information for the public good, the researchers and demographers said. In fact, the experience of the last few years has undermined user trust in the Census Bureau. Differential privacy algorithms add intentional errors to data to obscure the identity of any given participant and are most noticeable at the smallest geographies, such as census blocks. In sports, in FIFA Men's World Cup, United States 1, Iran 0, the U.S. has survived to advance. Behind clutch Pulisic goal, solid defense, young U.S. MNT knocks off Iran in must-win match to earn spot and knockout round. Doha, Qatar. Now the knockout round starts for the U.S. men. Needing a victory over Iran to advance out of the group stage, the U.S. MNT got a goal in the 38th minute and hung on from there, surviving several late challenges from Iran to get a 1-0 victory on Tuesday. As the second place finisher in Group B, they will play the Netherlands, the Group A winner, on Saturday. The Americans dominated the Iranians for much of the first half, with their youth more than outweighing their inexperience. They were able to get balls and close down spaces quickly, and Sergino Dest and Tim Way repeatedly tested Iran's defense, which could do little but bunker down and block the last U.S. pass. But after failing to finish in their first two games, Christian Pulisic and the Americans weren't going to be denied. In the 38th minute, Weston McKennie chipped a long ball to Dest, who headed it across the goal, whereas streaking Pulisic found it. He knocked it in from close range with his right foot, setting off pandemonium among U.S. fans and the U.S. MNT bench. The jubilation briefly turned to concern, however, as Pulisic went down in a hard collision with Iran goalkeeper Alireza Berivand. Pulisic appeared to have taken a knee to his midsection and was down for several minutes. U.S. coach Greg Berhalter waved off a sub as Pulisic gingerly jogged along the sideline. After grabbing a sip of water, he went back in the game. The U.S. men's national team nearly doubled the lead in stoppage time when McKennie served up another gorgeous ball which Wade banked off the far post. But Wade was offside by inches, and the U.S. men's national team had to settle for a 1-0 lead. Iran had scored three of its four goals after the 90th minute, and they gave Matt Turner and the Americans everything he had in the final minutes of this one. The most dangerous came in the final minute when Iran called for a penalty on Cameron Carter-Vickers for holding in the box. Turner had come off his line, but Walker Zimmerman slid to clear the ball, and the U.S. MNT escaped. When the final whistle sounded, the Americans stood there, gassed. Several Iranians dropped to the ground while others stood with their hands on their hips. Despite their youth, even with 35-year-old Tim Ream and 33-year-old Sean Johnson, the U.S. men's national team had an average age of 25 years and 216 days and inexperience. DeAndre Yedlin was the only player on the 26-man roster to have played in a World Cup before. This group is determined to change how the world views American soccer. They have impressive individual credentials, with 17 of the 26 playing in Europe this season and 5 competing in the Champions League, but they need to make strides as a national team. The Americans won high praise for their performance against England in particular, and Iran coach Carlos Queiroz had called them the most consistent team in the group. They're probably even the team that made the best two performances in the tournament in our group, he said. But none of that would have mattered had the Americans not reached the knockout rounds. Our goal is obviously to win the World Cup. In order to do that, we have to get to the knockout stages, Zimmerman said before the Iran game. Because of draws in their first two games against Wales and England, the U.S. MNT only path out of the group was to beat Iran. And to beat Iran, the Americans had to score goals, something they struggled with in their first two games in Qatar. The Americans had created multiple chances against both Wales and England, but couldn't finish them. Rather than causing concern, McKennie said it was a sign the U.S. MNT was on the right track. If you create 100 chances, at least one of them is going to go in eventually, McKennie said after the England game. So the most important thing was that we created the chances and we can be a threat, and that'll just build. McKennie's words turned out to be prophetic. The U.S. MNT didn't convert all of its chances, but it got the one it needed. Captain America comes through. Of course, it was going to be Christian Pulisic who had the big moment for the Americans. He's the wunderkind of this uber-talented young generation of U.S. men. Captain America accomplished things no American has before for both club and country. If the USMNT is to make a run at this World Cup and make people rethink their worldview of American soccer, it's going to require something special from Pulisic. I don't see it as a burden at all. I'm very excited for the moment, he said before the tournament began. I'm going to do the best I can in representing this country, and I hope I make everyone back home proud. Oh, I'd say he's got that covered. A hard collision with Iran's goalkeeper sent Pulisic to the hospital, but with an abdominal injury Tuesday night, but not before his goal in the 38th minute gave the USMNT what it needed to beat Iran 1-0 and advance out of the knockout rounds. Back in the World Cup for the first time since 2014, the U.S. men's national team will be one of the last 16 teams standing. That's what he does, U.S. coach Greg Berhalter said. That's the special quality that he has. Goals have been hard for the USMNT to come by at this tournament. Anywhere, really, with just three in the six matches over the last 3 months. But with the USMNT needing to win to advance, someone was going to have to find the back of the net. Who better than Pulisic? On a team of players talented enough to be playing at the top clubs in Europe and the Champions League, Pulisic remains its talisman. He's the one who has blazed a new path for U.S. players going to Europe as a young teenager and winning a Champions League title with Chelsea, and he commands the largest spotlight. When the U.S. men's national team needs someone to make something happen, more often than not, they look to Pulisic. Weston McKennie chipped a long ball to Sergino Dest, who headed across the goal in the direction of Pulisic. Lurking near the back post, Pulisic ran onto the ball, knocked it in with his right foot. How many goals has he scored like this in his career? Tyler Adams asked. Back post arriving, he's brilliant the way that his timing is into the box. To get in front of that ball, he'll do anything for his team in order for us to win, including sacrificing his body. The momentum of his shot carried Pulisic forward, and he collided at full speed with Iran goalkeeper Alizera Birivand. Pulisic was down for several minutes before getting up and walking gingerly toward the U.S. sideline. He tried jogging, stopped for a sip of water, then went back into the game. It was clear he was hurting, however, and it didn't come out for the second half. He was taken to a local hospital for tests and diagnosed with a pelvic contusion, according to U.S. Soccer. Pulisic was back at the team hotel before the rest of the U.S. squad arrived from the game. The U.S. men now play the Netherlands on Saturday with a chance to reach the quarterfinals for the first time since 2002. Pulisic is listed as day-to-day, but McKennie said he has no doubts he'll be on the field. I think he'll be fine, McKennie said. I sent him a text, then we checked on him, and he said, best believe I'll be ready on Saturday, so I think he was very happy. As was the entire U.S. men's national team. Relieved, too, after withstanding a barrage from Iran late in the game. A free kick in the third minute of stoppage time was barely wide of the near post. In the eighth minute of stoppage time, Walker Zimmerman made a goal line clearance after a shot by Mehdi Taremi, got behind Matt Turner. Iran wanted a penalty, saying Cameron Carter-Vickers had been holding one of its players, but was unsuccessful in its protest. A minute later, the final whistle blew, and the Americans were into the knockout rounds. When the U.S. men's national team returned to the locker room, they FaceTimed Pulisic. I think everyone was screaming, so we couldn't really hear too much. He was just excited, Turner said. That's the kind of guy he is. He put everything on the line there and was able to get the ball across the line, something we haven't done too much in this tournament. He left everything out there. Pulisic has been dreaming about playing in the World Cup since he was a little boy. He was going to do whatever it took to get the U.S. men here, and he'll do whatever it takes to keep them here, too. Tiger laments foot ailment that forced him out of Hero World Challenge by Adam Shupak. Nassau, Bahamas. When asked if he could name all 206 bones in the body, Tiger Woods didn't miss a beat in cracking, pun intended, a joke. I know of the ones that hurt, okay, he said, breaking, pun intended, into a smile. Woods, 46, announced his latest ailment in a tweet on Monday, citing plantar fasciitis in his right foot as the reason he'll be unable to compete this week at the Hero World Challenge, where he also serves as tournament host and his foundation is the main beneficiary. "It was a tough decision just because I want to play. I like playing, I like competing, but unfortunately I can hit the golf ball and hit whatever shot you want, I just can't walk," he explained during a pre-tournament press conference on Tuesday. "I've had a few setbacks during the year that I still was able to somehow play through, but this one I just can't. Only time can heal this one and stay off my feet and get a lot of treatment done." Woods has played just 9 competitive rounds this year. The more Woods ramped up his practice ahead of the tournament, the pain in his foot worsened. "The worst thing you can do is walk, and I was walking more and more and more, trying to get my legs ready for this event, and I just kept making it worse," Woods said. "So I had to shut it down and unfortunately be the host of the event and Ranger Rick out there." During his remarks, Woods noted that he has undergone 2 more surgical procedures this year, but when pressed for more basic information, such as what the surgeries were for and when they happened, he demurred, only would confirm that they happened this year. Woods did confirm that he was under the weather during the British Open in July, but that he never tested positive for COVID-19. He also confirmed that the plantar fasciitis is related to other injuries to his foot that he suffered in a 1 car accident in February 2021. Woods said he will require a month or 2 of rest to allow his foot to heal properly. "It's a balancing act, right?" he said. "How hard do you push it to make progress while not pushing it too hard to go off the edge and you set yourself back 2-3 days, and that's been the balancing act the whole year. Trying to do that, get ready for this event, I did a lot of beach walks trying to simulate the sand out there, and my foot just did not like that very much." Woods competed in 3 majors this season: the Masters, where he finished tied for 47th, the PGA Championship, where he withdrew after the 3rd round, and the British Open, where he missed the cut, and he said he exceeded his own expectations, which were to simply play in the British at the St. Andrews, Scotland, in Scotland, the home of golf, potentially for the last time. Despite the pain in his foot, Woods remains confident that he can play in the match, a 12-hole exhibition scheduled for December 10th, pitting Woods and Rory McIlroy against Justin Thomas and Jordan Spieth, as well as the PNC Championship, a 2-person team event with son Charlie. "This will be a tough week. The father-son will be a very easy week. Charlie will just hit all the shots and I'll just get the putts out of the hole. So pretty easy there," Woods said. "But other than that, in the match we're playing in, we're flying in the carts." Woods reiterated his stance that he won't request to use a cart at a sanctioned PGA Tour event, noting that the PNC Championship, where he used a cart in the past, is sanctioned by the rules of the PGA Tour of Champions. As for his future plans, Woods made it clear that his schedule in 2023 will be, at best, limited once again. "The goal is to play just the major championships and maybe 1 or 2 more. That's it. I mean, that's physically, that's all I can do," he said. "I don't have much left in this leg, so gear up for the biggest ones and hopefully, you know, lightning catches in a bottle and I'm up there in contention with a chance to win. And hopefully, I remember how to do that." That's all the time I have for now. This is Dan Cobrin reading the Brockton Enterprise for November 30th, 2022 for the Talking Information Center.
You've just heard news stories from the Brockton Enterprise. Please stay tuned for more programming.
Here's the forecast for the Boston and South Shore area on the Talking Information Center from the National Weather Service. Lots of wind and rain today, especially in the afternoon, evening, and overnight hours. Temperatures in the upper 50s. Overnight, more wind, more rain. Temperatures dropping to the mid-30s. And for Thursday, mostly sunny. Temperatures in the lower 40s. The sun rose this morning at 6:56, setting at 4:13 this evening. Stay tuned for more heading your way next on the Talking Information Center.
What is AA? Alcoholics Anonymous is an international fellowship of men and women who've had a drinking problem.
It is non-professional and self-supporting.
AA is multiracial, apolitical, and available almost everywhere.
There are no age or education requirements. Membership is open to anyone who wants to do something about their drinking problem.
Call 617-426-9444 or find online meetings at aa-intergroup.org.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, Play Radio Station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WVUF Liberal, WRS Liberal, WRS LP Pittsfield, WLLA Mandatory, WVAL LP Alpha, WDJ Framingham.
Coming up next from the Talking Information Center, news stories from the Taunton Daily Gazette.
This is Pamela Ann Peters for the Talking Information Center, reading the Taunton Daily Gazette. Somerset Berkeley Band to perform at Pearl Harbor Memorial Parade. Band students at Somerset Berkeley Regional High School are getting a special opportunity, an invitation to travel to Hawaii and represent Massachusetts in the parade marking the anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attacks. It's very, very exciting. It's quite an honor to be able to go, said Christina Rausch, the school's band director. The students have been working really hard. 40 students from the school's concert and marching bands will fly to Hawaii next month for the 81st Pearl Harbor Memorial Parade, held on the anniversary of the attack that killed more than 2,000 people, mostly U.S. service members, and prompted the country's entry into World War II. One school band is selected to represent each state. Rausch said Somerset Berkeley has made a name for itself as having a competitive band program, but the invitation letter still came as a surprise. Students will get a serious history lesson, as they will have a chance to visit sites like the USSS Arizona Memorial Museum and the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific, along with performing on the deck of the USS Missouri, the historic battleship that was the site of Japan's official surrender at the end of World War II. Local businesses and groups like the Somerset Friends of Music and Bay Coast Bank are helping to cover the cost of flying dozens of students and chaperones, along with their instruments, to Hawaii. Band parents have also launched an online fundraiser to help offset some of the cost. I'm just overwhelmed by how supportive everyone has been, Rausch said. Top 10 2021 Municipal Salaries in Dighton. Which municipal employees made the most in Dighton in 2021? The Gazette analyzed salary data from the town of Dighton and the Dighton-Rehoboth Regional School District to get the answer. The town had 221 employees in 2021, while the DR Regional School District had 406 employees, not including substitute teachers. The top 10 is made up entirely of police, fire, and school department employees. And just because someone holds the top position in the department, that doesn't mean that person is the top earner, after overtime is factored in. That's because, as in Taunton and other communities, overtime pay is a substantial chunk of the total for many of the highest earning employees. In both the police and fire departments, though the chiefs may be the top 10 highest earners left for the town, they earn less than some of the lower ranking employees due to overtime. Overtime pay is a difference marker. Fire Captain Christopher Reddy had the most overtime pay in the fire department in 2021 and for the town as a whole, coming in at $54,216. He was followed by firefighter paramedic Alexander D. Green with $43,402 and police officer Nicholas A. Barrows with $37,617. Top female earners in Dighton. Former DR Special Education Director Kristen L. Donahue represents the only woman in the top 10 highest earners townwide at $121,000. She is followed by retired Palmer River Elementary School principal Arlene Miguel, who is 16th on list overall at $111,012. In the top 100 for just the school district, women represent around 75% of the highest earnings, or 3 out of 4. 13 women made the top 50 highest earnings municipal workers in 2021. On the municipal side, the highest earning woman for the town in 2021 was Mary J. Hathaway, former treasurer, at $85,803, making her the 23rd highest earning on the municipal side. If both municipal and school district salaries are combined, she would drop to 81st, as a lot of the DR teachers make upwards of $90,000 annually. Here are the top 10 highest earners for Dighton in 2021. Anthony Azar, former superintendent of schools, $173,743. Number 2, Christopher Reddy, fire captain, $165,700, including $54,216 in overtime. Number 3, Gregory B. Steele, police officer, $160,866, including $35,449 in overtime. Number 4, Nicholas A. Barros, police officer, $149,281, including $37,617 in overtime. Number 5, George L. Nichols, Jr., police sergeant, $144,751, including $21,895 in overtime. Number 6, Robert L. McDonald, retired police chief, $140,325. Number 7, Robert Baxter, DR Business Administration Station, $129,000. Number 8, Christian L. Donahue, DR Special Education Director, $121,000. Number 9, Christopher McGay, Fire Chief, $119,470. Number 10, Sean P. Cronin, former police lieutenant, current police chief, $119,373, including $13,244 in overtime. Other noteworthy salaries, Town Administrator Michael Mullen makes $99,392, Selectman gets a stipend of $5,000 annually. Fetterman turns attention to governing. When John Fetterman goes to Washington in January as one of the Senate's newest members, he'll bring along a new reverend style from Pennsylvania that extends from his own personal dress code, super casual, to hanging marijuana flags outside his current office in the state capitol. Pennsylvania's unique lieutenant governor, who just flipped the state's open Senate to Democrats, may be the only senator ever to be declared an American taste god, as GQ magazine once did. The 6'8" Fetterman will tower over the currently tall senator, Republican Tom Cotton of Arkansas, by 3 inches. And he might be the most tattooed senator, if not the only tattooed senator. He may break some things. He can be aggressively progressive, campaigning hard in a pledge to kill the filibuster rule. He also might become the senator's biggest media attraction. He's plain-spoken, and especially on social media, has a wicked wit. He has a fan of Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who called Fetterman's race the nation's marquee contest, a victory for a progressive candidate who focused on economic issues, middle-class struggle, and the increasing enrichment of the rich. And I think if there's any candidate who is running more than anybody else, who identified with the working class, who made clear that he was going to Washington to represent working people, it was John Fetterman, Sanders told the Associated Press. Fetterman has played down his own progressivism. Instead, he said the Democratic Party has come around to his long-held positions, such as legalizing marijuana, and has held himself out as a Democrat who votes like a Democrat. On the campaign trail, Fetterman said he would like to emulate his fellow Pennsylvania Democrat, third-term Senator Bob Casey. Casey doesn't expect Fetterman's progressive politics will sideline him, saying Democrats already have a broad coalition that can get things done in President Joe Biden's priorities. So I think John will fit well into that, Casey said. And there'll be time when he's got an issue he wants to pursue that not everyone will want, but we can work through those. Fetterman, 53, is fresh off winning the midterm election's most expensive and probably most unusual race for Senate. In the middle of the campaign, Fetterman survived, then recovered from the stroke that he says almost killed him. He went on to beat Dr. Mehmet Oz, the heart surgeon turned TV celebrity who moved from New Jersey to run. Fetterman still suffered from a stroke's common after effect that could require him to use closed captioning in hearings, meetings, and debates. Fetterman's fashion sensibility, he sports hoodies and shorts even in winter, came up on his campaign trail when Republicans plastered him as someone who dresses like a teenager. Senator John Kennedy, Republican of Louisiana, jokingly told one crowd that Oz at least wears pants. In the Senate, Fetterman joins the clubbiest of all clubs, 100 of the nation's ultimate insiders. His supporters see him differently as an outsider and regular guy who became a progressive hero as the mayor of a Pittsburgh satellite community. One supporter, Lydia Thomas, says he's for the little Pennsylvania guys. Fetterman's campaign struck a balance between insiderism and outsiderism. He forged bonds with Casey and Governor Tom Wolf and got high-profile campaign trail help from Biden and former President Barack Obama. But as Lieutenant Governor, he forged a reputation as someone who didn't snooze with the state lawmakers as a candidate who didn't kiss party insiders' rings. On the campaign trail, Fetterman regularly used Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia as a foil, saying Manchin doesn't vote like a Democrat should and won't get rid of the filibuster. Manchin's office wouldn't comment. Fetterman has dismissed questions of how he'd fit into the Senate, saying it should be the least of anybody's concerns given the stakes. Here's what I promise never to do. I promise to never incite a riot in Capitol Hill. I promise to never stand on the floor of the Senate after I've been driven from it by a bunch of rioters and lie about our election in Pennsylvania, Fetterman said in an interview last year. During the 2020 presidential campaign, Fetterman was in high demand from TV networks. As a senator, he may again be in high demand from the Sunday talk shows, and his social media feeds would bear watching after his campaign drew national attention with how it trolled Oz relentlessly. Then there's his wardrobe. Fetterman said that he will wear a suit in the Senate chamber, and sure enough, when he showed up for orientation earlier this month, he wore one. He isn't entirely a stranger to dressing up. He has worn a suit while presiding as Lieutenant Governor in the State Senate. That may not last, though. Casey suggests that the dress code isn't always enforced, noting that some Republican senators lately have shown up without ties or without a jacket. Fetterman has not always shown reverence for job expectations or requirements he may not like. For instance, as Lieutenant Governor, he skipped dozens of Senate voting sessions where he was supposed to preside. Twice, Republican senators removed him as a presiding officer in the middle of a voting session in partisan disputes over four rules. Not only that, he ruffled feathers by hanging flags, such as the pro-marijuana legalization and LGBTQ and transgender rights flags from the door of the Lieutenant Governor's office on the balcony overlooking the state's Capitol's sweeping front steps. Republicans, complaining he was turning his Capitol office into a door room, slipped a provision into a lame duck budget legislation to stop it, prompting Fetterman to lampoon them as marshaling the gay pride police. The U.S. Senate will have its own partisanship and its own transactional dealings between members. Casey said Fetterman is prepared for it. What may be the biggest exchange for Fetterman, Casey said, is the demand of his time. Most people don't have that kind of schedule. We're sometimes in Washington more than the state you represent, Casey said. Did he inspire Ben Affleck? Fall River career bank robber charged again. So much for second chances. A Fall River man who claims to be an inspiration for Ben Affleck's character in the bank heist film, The Town, has been charged in connection with the robbing of a TD Bank branch in downtown Boston. Yet 2 years ago, he appeared in the popular Cotton Province TV show and received a reprieve for several outstanding traffic tickets, largely because he expressed remorse for his bank robbing past and a desire to change his life. William Sakira, 59, who was charged with one count of bank robbery and will appear in federal court in Boston at a later date, according to a press release from the Office of United States Attorney Rachel S. Romans. Fall River police were able to help law enforcement officials connect the dots after a September bank robbery on Rodman Street. According to the charging documents, on September 30th, a white male, later identified as Sakira, entered the TD Bank branch on Union Street in Boston. Once inside, Sakira allegedly approached a teller and stated, "Give me all of $100 in the drawer and give me all the money before I blow your brains out." Sakira fled on foot after obtaining money from the teller. It is alleged that surveillance footage of the robbery and subsequent interviews positively identified Sakira as the robber. On October 5th, law enforcement surveilling the Back Bay area in an effort to locate Sakira spot him entering a Citizens Bank branch on Boylston Street in Boston. There, it is alleged that Sakira approached the teller, said, "Give me hundreds," and threatened to shoot the teller if they did not move fast enough. Sakira was immediately apprehended. Sakira is also facing charges in Fall River in connection to a robbery at the Citizens Bank located at 501 Rodman Street. Detective Louis Vertentes of the Major Crimes Division was assigned as a lead investigator in this case, according to a press release from the FRPD. During his investigation, Vertentes shared photographs of the robbery suspect within the department in hopes of identifying him. Members of the gang unit told Vertentes that the suspect resembled an individual suspected of multiple bank robberies in and around Boston. In fact, Officer Eric Patrikouf of the Special Operations Division remembers speaking to a man during a detail who told him that Ben Affleck had made a movie in the town about a band of bank and armored car thieves in which the main character was based on him. He also told Pacheco that he'd been in an episode of Cotton Province with Judge Frank Caprio. In the episode, he told Caprio he had served 37 years in federal prison for bank robbery. He was asking for leniency with regard to some traffic tickets. Caprio seemed intrigued by his stories. Sakira told him when he was caught, he had $500,000 hidden in his fridge in milk containers. He also claimed to have been involved in the largest police chase in violent history after robbing a bank in Cranston. But he also said he was trying to turn his life around, making deliveries for a reporter's company, and said he didn't ever want to end up in prison again. Caprio ended up wiping out his $150 in traffic tickets, thanks to a donation he received for someone who deserves a break. On October 4th, Pretentes was able to alert law enforcement in Boston that Sakira was en route to that city. The charge of bank robbery provides for a sentence of up to 20 years in prison, 3 years of supervised release, and a fine of $250,000. Sentences are imposed by federal district court judge based upon the U.S. sentencing guidelines and statutes, which govern the determination of a sentence in a criminal case. The writing deciphers conservative media for outsiders. Project started after Trump inauguration has nearly 10,000 subscribers. Nearly 6 years into monitoring the content of conservative media outlets for his website newsletter, The Writing, Howard Polskin hasn't lost the capacity for surprise. Case in point, when Donald Trump announced his 2024 presidential candidacy, and many of his longtime media allies let fly with anger and insults, 2 impeachments, 2 years of election denials, and a U.S. Capitol riot didn't have the impact of a disappointing showing by Republicans in the midterm elections. "I didn't expect the level of vitriol. There's no question about it," he said. Trump's inauguration in 2017 started Polskin on his journey. A New York-based former reporter and publicist for the likes of CNN and J.K. Rowling, Polskin was mystified at why his fellow Americans had elected Trump and sought explanations. He began citing outlets popular with conservatives and sending links to fellow left-leaning friends who wouldn't think of clicking on the Washington Free Beacon, the Epic Times, PJ Media, or Chicks on the Right. "I didn't start as a business," he said. "I started it for myself." It has grown to a newsletter with subscribers that number nearly 10,000 and a website. Polskin, with a former Newsweek editor and freelance writers, does original reporting on people behind the outlets and covers trends like the targeting of transgender rights and how powerful women of color are disparaged. He's produced an AZ Guide to Right-Wing Media with 130 entries. The Writing also follows which sites are gaining and losing popularity in industry fully dominated by FoxNews.com. Polskin is impatient for more people who are not in mission conservative media to read what he's compiling. He received an important endorsement when California Governor Gavin Newsom said in September that he reads the writing each morning. Newsom told Politico that it gives him a different appreciation and a different understanding of the ruthlessness of the right. People who are not fans don't appreciate the breadth of the conservative media ecosystem and how it has spread beyond radio and websites into podcasting, publishing, and YouTube channels, Polskin said. The left doesn't come anywhere close. He's not switched sides, but Polskin admits his work has pushed him more towards the political center. He's grown to appreciate the talents of certain writers, like Town Hall columnist Kurt Schlichter, a lawyer and former stand-up comic, and Ray Cardello, a blogger from New Hampshire. Prior to the writing, I never went to these sites, and has opened my mind to a different way of thinking, he said. While I might not agree with it all the time, I get the underlying philosophy. He worries about the sites succeeding in painting Democrats as having views on the fringe and making them unpalatable to many Americans. Scroll through some of the headlines Polskin has collected, and you'll find conventional conservative wisdom mixed with some of that borderline bizarre. Wokeness is the acid dissolving Christianity. Unvaccinated women shun vaccinated single women. Single men. Climate extremism is making Americans mentally ill. And DeSantis flashes his alpha dog energy in meeting with diminished Biden. Pre-election newsletters contain an assortment of cold takes, bet the house on a GOP landslide. Even Dems now realize midterm elections could be a bloodbath. All signs to point to a landslide for liberty, and Fetterman is toast. I might ridicule something, but I'm careful with that, Polskin said. I don't want to get in a war with anyone. It would be time-consuming and distracting. For now, Polskin said the writing is a brand in search of a business. A Ford Foundation grant he received in May provides the bulk of the funding, and Polskin is exploring ways to have readers donate. It has no advertising. Polskin is opposed to that, although he did turn down ad requests from a gun manufacturer. I enjoy Howard quite a bit, said Cardello, whose conservative view from New Hampshire blog is often quoted in the writing. I know what side he comes from, but you can still have a civil conversation with him. That hasn't always been the case with friends and even relatives, since Cardello started putting his views online. He said he appreciates the exposure Polskin has given to writing to people of all points of view. Otherwise, you're just singing for the choir, he said. I put my work out there. If the only people who read it are conservatives, what have I really accomplished? But Cardello said he hasn't gotten a great deal of feedback from people for the writing. Two editors at the prominent sites frequently quoted by Polskin didn't return calls for comment. Polskin said he saw real anger in the conservative press about the midterm election results and a need to blame someone. Trump was the most obvious choice. He's interested to see whether the break with Trump is permanent and is by no means unanimous. In one sign of softening, WND wrote that Trump has promised to make America great again, and is probably the only person who can do it. And there's always the tried-and-true target, as the headline and gateway pundit illustrated, Dems steal midterm as communism comes to America. Biden hosts congressional leaders to discuss agenda. President Joe Biden hosted congressional leaders at the White House on Tuesday to discuss his agenda for the remainder of the year as he looks to ensure government funding and locking more legislative wins before Democrats lose control of the House in January. The meeting comes as the government faces a December 16 shutdown if lawmakers don't agree on funding legislation to keep lights on. Biden also wants the legislation to provide additional money for the COVID-19 response and to bolster U.S. support for Ukraine's economy and defense against Russia's invasion. Biden has also called on Congress to step in and impose a tentative agreement between railroads and workers to avoid a potentially crippling freight rail strike on December 9th. We're going to work together, I hope, to fund the government, Biden told lawmakers, emphasizing the importance of Ukraine and pandemic funding as well. Biden said the economy is at risk because of the looming rail strike and said he is confident that Congress can act to avert it. There's a lot to do, including resolving the train strike, he said. Biden sat at the head of the table, flanked on either side by Democratic House Leader Nancy Pelosi and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, the two smiling brightly at the top of the meeting as the President spoke. Republican House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy sat next to Schumer, and Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell was next to Pelosi in the resolute room, and they were more reserved. Biden quipped, "I'm sure this is going to go very quickly to reach agreement on everything." McCarthy is working to become Speaker in January, although he must first overcome dissent within the GOP conference to win a floor vote on January 3rd. Congress is also taking up legislation to codify the same-sex marriage, raise the debt limit, and reform the Electoral Act in a bid to prevent another attempt like in 2020, when then-President Donald Trump and allied lawmakers tried to overturn the will of the voters in the presidential election he lost to Biden. NATO. Membership aid coming for Ukraine, but holding off Russia remains first priority. NATO allies reaffirmed their commitment to Ukraine on Tuesday, saying that the war-torn nation will one day become a member of the world's largest security alliance and promising more help, from winter aid to artillery, to help Ukraine's beleaguered armed forces to fight off Russia. The pledges of support in Romania's capital, Bucharest, came as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with NATO foreign ministers Tuesday to drum up urgently needed support aimed at ensuring that Moscow fails to defeat Ukraine as it bombards vital energy infrastructure. NATO's door is open, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said before chairing the meeting. Russia does not have a veto on countries joining, he said in reference to the recent entry of North Macedonia and Montenegro into the Security Alliance. He said that Russian President Vladimir Putin will get Finland and Sweden as NATO members soon. The Nordic members applied for membership in April, concerned that Russia might target them next. "We stand by that, too, on membership for Ukraine," the former Norwegian Prime Minister said. In essence, Stoltenberg repeated a vow made by NATO leaders in Bucharest in 2008, in the same sprawling palace of the parliament where the foreign ministers are meeting this week, that Ukraine and also Georgia would join the alliance one day. Some officials and analysts believe that this move, pressed on NATO allies by former U.S. President George W. Bush, was partly responsible for the war that Russia launched in Ukraine in February. Stoltenberg disagreed. "President Putin cannot deny sovereign neighboring nations to make their own sovereign decisions that are not a threat to Russia," he said. "I think what he's afraid of is democracy and freedom, and that's the main challenge for him." Beyond Ukraine's immediate needs, NATO wants to see how it can help the country longer term by upgrading its Soviet area equipment to the alliance's modern standards and providing more military training. This will help Ukraine to join the NATO more quickly in the years after the war has ended. Slovak Foreign Minister Radoslav Kacer said the allies must help Ukraine so the transition to full membership will be very smooth and easy once both NATO and Kyiv are both ready for accession talks. Even so, Ukraine will not join NATO anytime soon, with the Crimean Peninsula annexed and Russia troops and pro-Moscow separatists holding parts of the south and east. It's not clear what Ukraine's borders will even look like. This is all the time that we have for the news for today. This has been Pamela Ann Peters for the Talking Information Center, reading the Taunton Daily Gazette.
You've just heard news stories from the Taunton Daily Gazette. Please stay tuned for more programming. With disabilities and people who are legally blind can now apply for free or reduced MBTA fares online. The online applications for the MBTA's free or reduced fare programs offer riders a convenient method to apply for and receive a new free or reduced fare Charlie card without having to visit the Charlie Card store. Riders can apply to these respective programs remotely and easily online from a computer or mobile device in English, Chinese, Spanish, and Portuguese. Each application allows applicants to securely enter their personal information and upload the required documents, such as a photo ID and eligibility documentation. All online applications are accessible to screen readers and were tested by free and reduced fare riders to ensure usability. Riders who submit their email address as part of their application will receive application status notifications, including details on how to use their card if approved. In addition to the online applications, the MBTA recently removed rider photos, names, and expiration dates from senior Charlie cards for people 65 and older to simplify the card fulfillment process for these riders. Riders who apply for a new or replacement senior Charlie card will now receive the new reduced fare Charlie cards for seniors, which are valid for 8 years. Riders with current senior Charlie cards can utilize them until they expire. To learn more about the MBTA's free and reduced fare programs and how to apply online, visit this website, mbta.com/fares/reduced. That again, mbta.com/fares/reduced.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local